This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to this installment of Witness to Yesterday, the podcast of the Champlain Society. My name is Greg Marshaldon, and today we are going to talk to Jennifer Brown, one of Canada's most distinguished ethnohistorians. Formerly professor and director of the Centre for Rupert's Land Studies at the University of Winnipeg, Professor Brown fostered a much greater understanding between scholars, the general public, First Nations, and Métis communities. Professor Brown grew up in the United States studying archaeology and cultural social anthropology. She obtained her PhD in anthropology at the University of Chicago. Her dissertation research was turned into a very influential book, Strangers in Blood, Fur Trade Company Families in Indian Country, that was published by UBC Press in 1980. In 1983, she was hired as an associate professor in history at the University of Winnipeg and moved to Canada, where she had family roots. In 2008, she was elected as a Fellow of the Royal Society of Canada in recognition of her academic achievements. She retired from the University of Winnipeg in 2008, but continues to be a very active scholar. So active, in fact, that we are going to talk about two of her recent books, Ojibwe Stories from the Upper Barrens River, A. Irving Hollowell and Adam Bigmouth in Conversation, published in 2018, and An Ethnohistorian in Rupert's Land, Unfinished Conversations, was published in 2017. Professor Brown, welcome to Witness to Yesterday, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, please tell us a little bit about your family roots in Canada and how they might have influenced your career choices, including your move to Canada.
Well, my parents grew up in Toronto. They both went to the University of Toronto. Deep family roots all across Ontario, kind of a web of connections. And so the connection is quite deep there. And my father got his PhD at Columbia University in 1934, in French literature and history of science. And in the 30s, there were very few academic jobs of any sort in Canada, and he ended up spending his whole teaching career in the States, mainly at Brown University. So I was born in Providence, Rhode Island. And so that's how it happened that, you know, he's a Canadian who actually never gave up Canadian citizenship, always had a green card, and stayed in the States until he retired to back to Ontario in 1972. So many connections there, many relatives, many ancestors, one of whom was his grandfather, Edgerton R. Young, who was a Methodist missionary and preacher who served in northern Manitoba for a number of years and ended up writing about that experience and preaching about it and so on. And that was one source of interest in for me in the Northwest, in Ontario, in Manitoba, as well as Ontario. And when opportunity offered, I carried on looking at family documents and then archival documents more broadly and getting very interested in the stories of the indigenous people whom he knew, and also going farther back, the fur trade.
You describe yourself as an ethnohistorian, and perhaps erroneously, I've always thought of this as someone who combines the use of primary documents on the one hand, that's the typical historian, with ethnographic sources that are typically generated by anthropologists in their role as participant observers. What I'm really interested in is, what is your definition of ethnohistory, and why do you invariably describe yourself as an ethnohistorian?
Well, it's been my primary professional identity, I guess, for a long time. I see the field, I guess I rejoice in the field, as an interdisciplinary field, one that crosses boundaries between departments, between disciplines, so that ethnohistory involves, yes, working with documents, original documents. It also involves many other things, oral history, for example, archaeology, linguistics. I think the defining point about it is that one listens as best one can to information that comes from all these different sources and tries to weave them together. And yes, it's anthropology and history, but it's also drawing on linguistics, on issues of translation, for example, archaeology. And all of these sources can feed in to give us a better picture of the indigenous people of the past and their relations with outsiders, newcomers.
Well, let's start with your most recently published book, Ojibwe Stories from the Upper Barrens River. You told me earlier that the theme in this book has really been a constant in your life. So what is the common theme, or what are the common themes that run through not only this book, but your life as a historian?
I think it comes back to documentary history as prime, really. I'm interested in how we read historical documents and how we read them closely, as carefully as we can, to understand the writers and the people behind them and the all of the voices that are woven into those documents. And so I find that a lot of my work has involved going back to the Barrens River documents that you've mentioned, also fur trade documents. One particular person of interest was George Nelson, a fur trader who wrote really interesting materials that were never published and were very expressive of his outlook and his feelings, his way of life, in a more personal way than was true of many better known fur traders. And So I think that's a common link, is trying to get back to these sources and understand them in the deepest way that we can, putting them in context, understanding the voices that speak through them.
I was fascinated by Adam Bigmau's stories and the way in which he told them to American anthropologist A. Irving Halliwell. Can you tell us a bit about both of these individuals?
Well, Halliwell was an American anthropologist who taught most of the time at the University of Pennsylvania, Philadelphia. And he got into doing original field work in Manitoba in 1930, was his first visit up there along the Barrens River. And he got to know the people very well, and he found that no other anthropologist had worked there before. The people were not well known. They retained their language, their Ojibwe language, very strongly. And they welcomed him, I think, because he was interested in them. And so many white men who came through were prospectors, fur traders, whatever, there for their own interests. And Halliwell was there to learn as much as he could about the people. So he really established a good relationship with them. And one of the people he met was Adam Bigmouth at Little Grand Rapids, about 50 portages up the river. And they began to work together, especially in 1938 and 40. And Adam, I think, really trusted Halliwell and really related to him well. And so they sat for hours with William Barrens, the chief from the mouth of the river, the Ojibwe chief who was bilingual, who served as interpreter. And Halliwell just wrote as fast as he could. He didn't have a tape recorder or a video camera or anything of the sort. He just took enormous numbers of notes, recording all of the stories that Adam was willing to tell him. And so it was evidently a very cordial relationship. And Halliwell never got around to publishing those stories, most of them himself. So they sat for a long time in archives in Philadelphia and in the Philosophical Society there. And when I was working on those materials, I began to make photocopies, as one does, of material, and copied a great many of the stories. And there they sat until I retired and I had time to really discover how important and interesting they were. And so that's when I started the process of transcribing and reading them closely, and decided that they really needed to be brought forward as very important source materials.
A while ago, you published something that was reproduced by the Champlain Society in how to edit historical journals, diaries, and narratives of this type. So how exactly did you edit this exchange and then provide us with the context for each of the vignettes that you presented?
Well, I think what really helped was that I'd been familiar with the Halliwell work, his writings and so on, from the 1970s onward, really. Two of my professors at the University of Chicago had actually studied as students with Halliwell. So I've mentioned at times that he was kind of an intellectual grandfather to me. And I knew his work. I respected it. I thought very highly of it. And when I moved to Manitoba, suddenly the opportunity was there to establish contacts with Barrens River people, to actually visit the places that Halliwell had visited and so on. And so that provided very rich context for looking at Adam's stories, and also identifying the people he mentioned, sort of doing the kinship links, who were all the connections that turn up in the stories, and also understanding the different beings about whom he told stories, the Wendigo and the other creatures, the other, as Halliwell called them, other than human persons, who appeared in people's dreams, who appeared in their life experience, and who turn up in the stories that Adam tells. So I had very rich context after having worked with a lot of this material for quite a long time. And so I felt I really could do him justice, I hope, in those stories.
So you describe Halliwell's influence in terms of your own approach. Are there areas where you differ from Halliwell?
Well, I think I differ in the sense that the fields of scholarship have changed so much in ways that he couldn't have imagined. Nowadays, it's not only technical that people have tapes and videos and ways to record in all sorts of ways that Halliwell never had, but also the issues of working in indigenous communities. Halliwell started out with a very warm permission from Chief William Behrens at the mouth of the river to work with people and meet them and begin to understand them. Nowadays, of course, the issues of consent and consent forms and prior permission and so many different things that cast fieldwork in a very different light. So that's a difference. But I guess I felt that I could go back to Halliwell's work kind of on his terms, understanding his context and appreciating what he was doing quite deeply in a time when he didn't have the means or strictures or structures or whatever that field workers face in the present time. So it was a different time. And in a way, as an ethnohistorian, I sort of rejoice in having the treasures of this material to work with and to bring them forward into the present, supplying context and background information and notes, footnotes, notes of all sorts as best I can.
The band show up again in your book of essays, The Ethnohistorian in Rupert's Land. And in fact, it's the entire focus of your final chapter in the book. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about William Behrens, the Ojibwe chief who spoke two languages, his own and English, and combined in his own way, as you put it, two bodies of knowledge and experience. How did Chief Behrens navigate the two worlds of Ojibwe spirituality or cosmology and the Methodist theology that he received growing up?
I think he had a very open mind. He lived at the mouth of the river where all sorts of people came by, and he made a point of meeting everybody who came by and stopped at the mouth of the river. He met missionaries and traders and prospectors and settlers and all sorts of people who came by. And he was interested in talking to all of them. And his father had given him some very good advice, his father, Jacob Behrens. He had said to his son, "Don't think you know everything. You will see many new things in your life, and you will find a place in your mind for them all." And I thought that was a wonderful saying. And it just expressed William Behrens' attitude of openness and interest in learning. And when he met Halliwell, Halliwell was such a good listener and just interested in hanging around and talking to him in depth. They established a very good relationship. And I think William Behrens also found that talking with Halliwell as an outsider, it reinforced his own sense of himself as an Ojibwe person, because Halliwell really valued those traditions and valued the history and valued the people. And so it was affirming, I think, for William to have that relationship. And for Halliwell, it was very, very special that over the next 7 years, in the summer times. He could return to visits to Barron's River, and they could go up the river together and meet William Barron's relatives up the river, who were very hospitable to them. And so the relationship was very strong, and it was reciprocal, and they each got different things out of the relationship, but they both had reasons to appreciate it and stick with it.
Well, just before I ask you about the reciprocal nature of the relationship, it sounds like it was very much reciprocal on both sides. We should tell our readers where the Barron's River is in terms of it's a river that flows into Lake Winnipeg in sort of the north central part of Lake Winnipeg on the east side. It goes by various names, but it's generally known as the Little Northwest. Let's get back to William Barron's again and Hallowell. To what extent was their relationship reciprocal?
Well, how could I say? Of course, Hallowell was paying William Barron's. He was also paying some other Ojibwe men who helped with the travels up the river, and so there was some material return involved. Another interesting thing is that Hallowell, when he came, he knew enough, he understood enough, that when he came, he also came with gifts. He came with things that people could use. Canned food, clothing, tobacco was a big thing. Tobacco was an important relationship builder. So he was appreciated on that front from the material side, but also the fact that they understood that he was bringing them useful things. So there was a benefit in that way. But as I say, I think the fact that he was such a good listener counted for a lot, because nobody else was listening. No outsiders were listening to them in the way that Hallowell did. Spending hours with them, recording as best he could, writing as fast as he could, and really paying attention to what they were saying and trying to understand they were trying to understand him, but he was trying to understand their concepts, their philosophy, their way of thinking. And language entered in here in a very important way. He never became fluent in Ojibwe, but he latched on to key concepts, and he would try to understand them as best he could. And so the whole issue of translation is very, very important in his work. And he knew the issues around translation, how difficult it was. And he really paid attention to trying to understand what people were trying to explain to him.
Now, Chief Barron's took him to upriver, and they met an individual named Fair Wind. Can you describe this person and what this introduction and subsequent conversation really opened up for Hallowell?
Well, Fair Wind, or Namawan, as they called him in Ojibwe, was a relative, a clan relative. The Ojibwe people have clans. William Barron's was a member of the Moose Clan, so was Fairwind and his relatives up the river. And the responsibility of clan members, people of the same clan, was that you were to be hospitable, you were to be friendly to them and recognize them as relatives, as cousins, and so on. And so that established a base for a relationship. And Fairwind was very elderly at the time, and he was blind. But he was very interested to meet Halliwell and to try to explain things to him. There's an interesting episode where Halliwell, at one point in his career, was trying to use Rorschach tests and giving people these funny pictures that would be interpreted in a psychological way. And Fairwind couldn't see, but his relatives were looking at these pictures, and he was listening to Halliwell talking to them. And so Halliwell was remembered as someone who, you know, came along and showed these funny pictures to people and asked them about them. And one of William Barron's descendants later on, who met him and who looked at these pictures, he said rather simply and wisely, I think, "Well, I think that Halliwell was trying to understand how an Indian thinks." And that was about as simple an explanation as you could give. But the back and forth over time is interesting. And the fact that Halliwell kept coming back on about five different summers going up the river and seeing the same people over and over again and meeting Fairwind, meeting Adam, meeting these other people, so that they knew who he was and they recognized him when he came.
Well, let's move from the Anishinaabeg of northern Manitoba now to northern Saskatchewan and Isle of La Crosse. I was interested in your essay on Charlotte Small, the wife of fur trader and explorer David Thompson. And of course, she grew up in Isle of La Crosse. Tell us a little bit about Charlotte Small, the history behind this essay, and what her life tells us about the role of women in the fur trade.
Okay, well, some years ago, there were a number of celebrations around David Thompson because it was the anniversary of some of his major discoveries and his major mapping of the Northwest, which was a really seminal, important thing, the mapping that he did. So a number of us realized that Charlotte was a pretty important figure, his wife, and had been neglected, and the historic sites and monuments people in Ottawa asked me if I would do a report on Charlotte, an academic report that could be used as a basis for recognizing her as a person of distinction, historical importance. So I undertook that, and it was a challenge because there weren't any of her own writings around. There were accounts of her. There was her long marriage to David Thompson, 50 years or more, I forget how many years. But there was a certain amount of speculation involved. But nonetheless, I could figure out quite a bit. Her father had been a Scotsman named Patrick Small, who left when she was around six or seven. There's no sign of an ongoing relationship there. He was a Northwest Company fur trader who came and established some relationships, and then he left and he went back to Scotland. And so she was brought up Cree. She was brought up by her Cree relatives, and her first language was Cree. And she was steeped in that way of life. And when she met David Thompson, it became a relationship that was important to him because she could be so helpful to him in various ways because of her ties with the people and her knowledge of the language and so on. And there seemed to be really some fresh affection between them, and the relationship went on forever. One issue that has arisen around Charlotte is that a good many people wanted to call her Métis because she had a Scottish father. And I argued against this because she was totally brought up as Cree. Her relatives were all Cree. Cree was her first language. And Métis in the 1780s and so on, when this relationship began, Métis was not a category that was on the scene in that region. And so she always was, you know, primarily identified as Cree, and Métis seemed to be kind of an imposed category that came afterwards by people who were going by criteria of blood, really, race, saying, well, she's half Scottish and half Cree, so therefore we can call her Métis. And I objected to that.
In chapter 11 of your Rupert's Land book, you go back to your early career as a scholar, and it always has struck me that 1980 was a real major year in terms of the intellectual history in Canada, because that's the year that your Strangers in Blood book appeared, and that's the year that Sylvia Van Kirk's book, Many Tender Ties, came into being. And, you know, in other circumstances, you'd think that two scholars who are working in somewhat the same area, but both making major discoveries and presenting quite original work at the same time, might be rivals, but you actually worked very closely together and collaborated. What drew the two of you together?
Well, when I was starting my research, I had to write to the Hudson's Bay Company archives, which were at the time in London, and request permission to use their documents, which were also available on microfilm in Ottawa. But I had to have their permission. So I wrote to them, and I got a letter back saying, well, yes, we can give you permission, but you should know that Miss Van Kirk is doing her doctoral degree at the University of London and is working on these archives, and she's working on a related topic, women and the fur trade. And, you know, maybe you might like to be in touch with her. So I wrote right away and introduced myself and told her what I was doing. And she wrote back right away and said she was glad to be in touch. And yes, we had interests in common. And she wrote a little bit about her approach, because she was doing a history degree and I was doing an anthropology degree. So we compared notes a little bit on that. But we were going over many of the same materials. We were interested in many of the same fur trade families. And we just began conversations that continued all along for a good many years. And yes, we both noticed that, you know, men scholars did not always establish these kinds of relationship. And, and you know, it was of interest that we were both women and we were both delving into fields that the male historians had really ignored. So we had that common sense of discovery, that yes, there were families and women and children and all sorts of people connected in the fur trade whose stories had never been told because everyone was so focused on the great men. So there was quite a commonality there, and it just continued and was very productive, I think.
Well, let's move from the early 1980s to the present. And this might be a little bit of an unfair question, but what do you think is the contemporary relevance of your work to today's Canada in light of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and other efforts to deal with our past as Canadians?
Well, the whole issue of the past is very fraught. And I'm reminded of the phrase, and I didn't go back and find the origin of it, the past is a foreign country. They do things differently there. And so my feeling has been that coming from the present and working in the present, so many people don't come to grips very much as they might with the past and what went on in the past and what people were really thinking and what they were really doing. And I guess my concern with documentation, again, going back to the documents, the primary sources, realizing that primary sources are imperfect, and you never get all the way back to what people actually thought and did and so on. But you do the best you can. And so as I look at the issues of missionaries and schooling and the fur trade and many other things, I'm interested in finding those voices from the past and listening as best as we possibly can. And we don't always like them in the present time. They said things we don't like. They did things that we certainly don't like. But how do we get back to the question of context? And I think context is all important. So I'll just take one quick example that I think helps to put this together, if I may. One hears quite a bit these days about Mother Earth, the concept of Mother Earth, and it's become a quite powerful concept in current indigenous spirituality among many people, and it's become quite widespread. Well, historically speaking, in Canada, the concept of Mother Earth never appeared in the older sources. It never appeared until the 1970s or 80s in Canadian thinking and Canadian writing, in Indigenous writing in Canada. And I've been working with a Cree scholar, Keith Goulet, in northern Saskatchewan, who's just completing his PhD at the University of Regina, actually. And he's worked a lot on this concept, and he's pointed out that in Cree, mother is an animate category, grammatically, and earth is inanimate. And when you put the two of them together in Cree, or in Ojibwe for that matter, it doesn't work grammatically, because they are grammatically two very different categories. And so there's a kind of a violence, in a sense, that's done to the language if you try to talk about Mother Earth in Cree. And people find various ways around this, which he has explored. But his basic point is, this is not a historical Cree concept. It's been brought in recent times, and you can understand in the current context why it's popular and why it's strong, but in terms of history, it wasn't there. So this is just one example of, I think, where work with Indigenous languages and Indigenous categories and Indigenous scholars is really important to gain these deeper perspectives.
Well, I'm so happy that you mentioned Keith Goulet. He's an old colleague of mine. I used to, in fact, work with him when he was in the cabinet of the government, and I was cabinet secretary, and I was very familiar with his doctoral work, and pleased to hear about this collaboration. So, Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
My guest today was Jennifer Brown. She is the author of Ojibwe Stories from the Upper Barrens River, A. Irving Halliwell, and Adam Bigmouth in Conversation, published by the University of Nebraska Press in 2018. She is also the author of An Ethnohistorian in Rupert's Land, Unfinished Conversations, published by the Athabasca University Press in 2017, and available through open access. You've been listening to Witness to Yesterday. Please visit our website at www.champlainsociety.ca, where you can become a subscribing member and help support the preservation and publication of documentary history. If you like what you've heard, let your friends know by forwarding this podcast through the social media of your choice. This podcast is made possible by the members of the Champlain Society. We want to thank the Hudson's Bay Company History Foundation, the L.R. Wilson Institute of History at McMaster University, and a consortium of Canadian scholarly book publishers that includes the University of Toronto Press, UBC Press, and the University of Ottawa Press. My name is Greg Marshaldon. This interview was recorded on December 4th, 2020, in the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic. It was produced by Jessica Schmidt.